Okay, welcome to the 55th episode of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. My name is Divine. I'm a PGY1 transitional year resident down in Ohio. I will be studying radiology next year. So in today's podcast, I'm going to be discussing some cardiopharmacology. Basically, this is going to be a series, and hopefully by the end, you should feel very comfortable with cardiopharm. My big goal is I'm going to really emphasize the physiology, really emphasize mechanisms, because many of these things, like you see people memorize it up the wazoo, it's actually pretty easy to understand if you just sort of put your ear down and really try to understand things. So to begin our discussion of cardiac pharmacology, I'm going to start by talking about the myocardial action potential. Right, and there's five phases to the myocardial action potential, right? So there's like phase four, where you basically have they're called like leak channels, right? So they are leak potassium channels. They are channels that are permeable to potassium, right? So because they are channels, they basically make things go down their gradient. And we know that potassium is primarily an intracellular ion, right? So the potassium sort of leak out of the cell, they go down their concentration gradient, they leave the cell, and that is essentially what establishes the negative resting membrane potential, which is usually around like negative 85 millivolts, okay? Although you can also say that a part of this is also created by the sodium potassium ATPase pump that pumps three sodiums out of cells and two potassiums into cells. And then there's a phase zero, right, where sodium sort of rushes into the cell through fast sodium channels, okay? Again, these sodium ions go down their gradient because sodium is primarily an extracellular ion, right? And again, that causes the cell to depolarize. And then we have phase one, which is basically mediated by potassium leaving the cell, okay? And then we have phase two, which is actually mediated by calcium going into the cell and potassium leaving the cell, right? So there you have potassium leaving the cell, which should make the membrane potential negative, but you have calcium coming in, which should make the membrane potential positive, right? So that sort of creates a kind of like a stalemate kind of business. And there's actually also sodium, something that's not talked about very often, but it's actually kind of high yield to understand this, at least for purposes of the antiarrhythmics, which I will touch on some today. In this phase two, there's actually also sodium coming in at this stage, and it actually uses very similar channels to the channels that operates in phase zero of the myocardial action potential. You'll see why that's important when we get to the class 1B antiarrhythmics. And then in phase three, right, which is the final phase, right, it's mediated by delayed rectifier potassium channels. This is basically potassium going out of the cell. The cell is repolarizing. And there are some kinds of refractory periods you sort of want to keep at the back of your mind. I'll say probably the big one is the effective refractory period. Actually, there's two, right? There's the effective, there's the absolute refractory period. I'll talk about both. For the effective refractory period, basically, this sort of occurs in phase three of the myocardial action potential. And basically, in the effective refractory period, if you have like a strong enough action potential coming down, the cell will fire, okay? And basically, because you're having like a new action potential coming along, right, it's basically this new action potential that's coming along that causes the cell to fire, kind of like in phase three of the myocardial action potential, it's known as an early after depolarization. And the thing is, calcium ions, I will say in general, are responsible for these early after depolarizations. So why is that important? The reason that's important is if you think about a drug like digoxin, actually places a patient at risk for an early after depolarization. So it's kind of proarrhythmic, right? Because the thing is, if you have an early after depolarization, not all your sodium channels have recovered, right? So you're basically delaying full repolarization, if you sort of think about it that way. And if you delay full repolarization, you kind of stretch out the action potential, right? And I mean, if the action potential is in phase three, and you get like a depolarization, again, the early after depolarization, again, you stretch out the action potential, you increase the length of phase three, right? And that will show up on an EKG as a prolongation of the QT interval, right? Because the QT interval kind of revolves around a ventricular repolarization, right? And if you prolong the QT interval, as you'll see as we keep going, that can cause a nasty arrhythmia known as a torsade de pointe, right? So again, to summarize, your QRS complex on an EKG relates to ventricular depolarization. It's fast, it's instantaneous. Versus your QT interval that revolves around ventricular repolarization. This takes a lot more time. In fact, if you look at an EKG, the QRS complex is like super quick versus the QT interval that is super long. And again, QT interval, ventricular repolarization, QRS complex, ventricular depolarization. So, some rules you want to take away. If you delay phase zero of the action potential, right, which is the quick part of the action potential, right, such as by like blocking a sodium channel, for example, that actually does not make much of a difference in the duration of the action potential on an EKG, okay? The only thing that will show up on an EKG is that, oh, you're just widening the QRS complex because that relates to ventricular depolarization. Alternatively, if you delay, if you delayed phase 3 of the myocardial action potential when you're essentially having ventricular repolarization, which we know is a longer process proportionally compared with ventricular depolarization, the duration of the action potential on the EKG will actually increase a lot, okay? And on an EKG, again, that will show up as a prolongation of the QT interval. So, again, if you do not have the ability to block potassium channels, you will not prolong the action potential duration. And then the second refractory period is the absolute refractory period. Basically, if a new action potential comes down during this period, the cell will not fire. So, now that we've talked about the myocardial action potential with five phases, let's talk about the pacemaker potential, which has three phases, okay? The pacemaker potential has three phases. Basically, there's a phase 4, a phase 0, and a phase 3. In phase 4, you basically have something known as a phonic current, okay? It's like a mixed sodium and potassium current. Basically, this phonic current essentially gives cells a property known as automaticity. What does automaticity mean? It just means that these cells have the ability to depolarize on their own, right? They can sort of like slowly depolarize on their own towards a given potential, and then the cell will fire, okay? So if you sort of think of it as a slope, like, oh, you're streaming up that slope for the cell to depolarize. The thing is, you want to be able to analyze those things in the context of the sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous systems, right? So for the sympathetic nervous system, it actually makes the heart go faster by making that slope for the phonic current for phase 4 steeper, okay? So it sort of like increases that slope, makes it much faster, right? Versus your parasympathetic nervous system, that actually makes the heart beat a lot slower, okay? By making the slope of phase 4, right, that phonic current slope, less steep, okay? So it basically kind of like slows down the heart, okay? And then after phase 4, we have phase 0. This is actually mediated by calcium, and it's mediated by calcium running in, sort of rushing into the cell, right? So that will cause a depolarization. And again, this calcium rushes in through L-type calcium channels. Please don't confuse L-type calcium channels with the T-type calcium channels that are blocked by the drug used for absence seizures, right? Ethosuximide. Remember, absence seizures like the 3 per second, 3 hertz spike and wave pattern. The drug of choice for the treatment of those kinds of seizures is ethosuximide. And then there is phase 3, which is mediated by potassium, okay? That basically causes repolarization of those cells. Now, the first drug I'll talk about here is ivabradine, right? So it's ivabradine. This drug, it's actually fairly new. It inhibits the phony sodium channels, again, which is part of phase 4, right, in pacemaker cells. So again, very high yield. It inhibits the phony sodium channels in pacemaker cells, right? So it inhibits phase 4 of the pacemaker potential. And basically by doing that, right, you basically decrease the activity of SA and AV nodal cells, right? So your sinoatrial and your atrioventricular nodal cells. So your heart rate actually decreases. However, it's actually super, super high yield to know that this drug does not decrease the force of contractility of your heart, right? So sort of contrast this with a beta blocker, for example. A beta blocker, I'll talk about those probably in a different podcast. Those are the class 2 antiarrhythmics, right? Beta blockers, right, they basically dumb down your sympathetic nervous system. So they decrease the slope of phase 4 of the pacemaker potential, but they also decrease cardiac contractility, okay? So beta blockers are negative chronotropes and inotropes. Ivabradine is a negative chronotrope, but it actually has no inotropic effects. Right, so why may this be useful? I mean, kind of think about this. Walk with me for a second here. If you have a patient that has severe heart failure, right, and they have like a 15% ejection fraction, so just ejection fraction essentially in the toilet, right? If you give them a beta blocker, the ejection fraction will decrease even more, right? Because beta blockers decrease contractility, they are negative inotropes. But think about it, if you decrease the heart rate only, if the only thing you brought down was the heart rate and you don't affect contractility, basically like the way ivabradin works, then the time you spend in diastole will actually increase because the heart is going slower, right? And if the time you spend in diastole increases, your end diastolic volume would increase. And if you think about the Frank Starling principle, that will actually increase your stroke volume, okay? And if your stroke volume increases, because cardiac output is heart rate and stroke volume, your cardiac output will increase as well, okay? So again, ivabradin is a negative chronotrope, but it has no inotropic effects. So let's jump to the antiarrhythmics, right? So we have the class 1 antiarrhythmics. These are the sodium channel blockers. So again, they basically delay phase 0 of the myocardial action potential. And again, on an EKG, you see that as a widened QRS complex, right? Because the QRS complex relates to ventricular depolarization. And the thing is, again, if you block sodium channels, you do not necessarily prolong the action potential duration. Because again, most of your time, if you look at the cardiac cycle, most of the time is spent in ventricular repolarization on an EKG, okay? So, again, because you spend most of your time in repolarization, basically the QT interval, if all you did was to block sodium channels, the action potential duration will not change by much, okay? Well, contrast this with like your class 3 antiarrhythmics, right? These are potassium channel blockers, right? So they delay phase 3 of the myocardial action potential, right? And basically, you capture this on an EKG with a prolongation of the QT interval, right? And as I said earlier, a prolonged QT interval can lead to something known as a torsade de pointe, which is a pretty fatal arrhythmia, although that's treated with magnesium. So again, I'll reiterate this point again. It's super, super high yield to understand. If you do not have the ability to block potassium channels, you will not, again, very high yield, you will not prolong the action potential duration. So let's visit these class 1 antiarrhythmics in a little more depth, okay? So again, they act on the myocardial action potential. There's three classes here. There's class 1 A, B, and C. Under class 1 A, we have drugs like disopyramide, right? Quinidine and procainamide. So the mnemonic there is double quarter pounder, okay? So disopyramide, quinidine, and procainamide, they block sodium channels, but they actually also have the ability to block potassium channels. And then after that, we have the class 1B agents. The mnemonic here is lettuce, mayo, and tomato, okay? So like lidocaine, mexiletine, and another drug known as tokenide. Although I want you to sort of put an extra drug in there, phenytoin. Think of phenytoin also as being a class 1B antiarrhythmic, okay? So the thing is, these class 1B drugs, they block phase 2 sodium channels, okay? They block phase 2 sodium channels, and those phase 2 sodium channels, they are known as the window channels. Remember I said that for phase 2 of the myocardial action potential, we have sodium rushing into the cell. I mean, we have potassium rushing out of the cell. We have calcium rushing into the cell. We sort of create a stalemate. But in addition, we also have sodium rushing into the cell during that phase 2. Okay? So your class 1B drugs, they are especially good at blocking phase 2 of the myocardial action potential. And by blocking these sodium channels in phase 2, those window channels, you basically make it easier for potassium to win the battle as potassium kind of rushes out of the cell. Okay? So this is actually why the action potential duration decreases with your class 1B antiarrhythmics. Because again, if you sort of think about like a tug of war, it's like, oh, you have sodium and calcium on one side and you have potassium on the other side. Potassium is coming out of the cell, sodium, calcium going into the cell. If you take out one of the guys, if you take out the sodium by blocking those window channels, the sodium doesn't rush into the cell anymore. So that means potassium wins the battle a lot earlier so that it can just go quickly into phase 3. Okay, so this is why your class 1B agents actually decrease the myocardial decrease the action potential duration. And then the class 3 the class 1C antiarrhythmics, you can use the mnemonic like fries, please. So like flecainide, propafenone. There's another drug known as encanide. Encanide is also a class 1C antiarrhythmics. These drugs, I think of them as the purest sodium channel blockers. Okay, so they have no effect on the action potential duration. So again, work with me here. The class 1A agents, they block sodium channels, but they also widen the QRS, but they also block potassium channels, so they'll prolong the QT interval. The class 1B agents, they block sodium channels, but one sodium channel that they're particularly specific for are the sodium channels in phase 2 of the myocardial action potential. So by blocking those sodium channels, as I painstakingly explained a few seconds ago, they actually decrease the action potential duration. And then for the class 1C drugs, they're the purest sodium channel blockers. They don't have any other drug description. All they do is that they block sodium channels. Okay, so if you're again looking at a gradation of things, the action potential duration is increased by class 1A agents because they have potassium channel blocking abilities. No effect whatsoever on the action potential duration is the purview of the class 1C agents, okay, because they are, again, they're the purest sodium channel blockers. They essentially do nothing else. And then if you're looking at decreasing the action potential duration, think about your class 1C drugs, okay, because they block those phase 2 sodium channels, right? So like the window sodium channels. And again, all these drugs, because they have sodium channel blocking activity, they widen the QRS interval, okay? Now, let's talk about another relatively complicated concept with these class 1 drugs. The thing is, a sodium channel can exist in, let's say, one of three states, okay? A sodium channel can exist in a resting state, okay? This is like what you see in phase 4 of the myocardial action potential. At that state, it's ready to fire, okay? Now, sodium channels can also exist in a state known as the open activated state. So they are open and they are working. That's more phase 0, right, of the myocardial action potential, because it's those sodium channels opening that make sodium rush into the cell to promote depolarization of the myocardium. And then the third state that a sodium channel can exist in is the closed inactivated state. So it's closed and sodium ions cannot run through that channel. Okay, so resting state, that's phase 4 of the action potential. So that's myocardial action potential. Resting open activated is phase 0, okay, of the myocardial action potential. And then closed inactivated is phases 1 and 2 and 3 of the myocardial action potential. So here's the deal. Why am I going through all this pain to explain this? The reason I'm going through all this pain is that sodium channel blockers can actually block sodium channels best in phases 0, 1, 2, and 3 of the myocardial action potential, okay? The thing is, the sodium channel blockers, your class 1A agents, are not very good at blocking sodium channels effectively in phase 4 of the myocardial action potential. So again, I'll reiterate this. Sodium channel blockers, your class 1 antiarrhythmics, they're very good at blocking phases 0, 1, 2, and 3 of the myocardial action potential, right? So those are sodium channels that are working in those phases. But in phase 4 of the myocardial action potential, your sodium channel blockers are not very effective at blocking those sodium channels, okay? And the thing is, if you're going through phases 0 to 3, right? Basically, the sodium channel is not available to do stuff, okay? It's not available because those sodium channels are basically inactivated at that spot, right? So if you think about it like phases 1, 2, and 3, the sodium channels are closed, they're inactivated because the cell is in a refractory period, if you may. But in phase 0, right, the sodium channels are already open, right? So it's not like you can like force them open again, right? So when you're in phases 0, 1, 2, and 3, okay, your sodium channels are said to be in use, okay? So if you're in phases 0, 1, 2, and 3, your sodium channels are said to be in use with respect to the myocardial action potential. But if you're in phase 4, the sodium channel is actually available, right? It's like it's basically in a resting state in phase 4, and it's ready to fire because essentially all the sodium channels have recovered. So one other concept I want to establish is that the faster your heart goes, right? So if your heart rate is faster, you actually spend more time in systole, okay? And I'll encourage you to sort of diagram this out. Just sort of like look at like the cardiac cycle and see like, oh, wait, if my heart is going faster, will I spend more time in systole or diastole? And the answer is you actually spend more time in systole, right? So if, and we said that when the heart is contracting and the heart is in systole, right? A lot of your, if you're basically spending a lot of time in phases 0 through 3 of the myocardial action potential. So We already established that sodium channel blockers, right? They love binding to sodium channels in phases 0, 1, 2, and 3, right? So when those sodium channels are in use and not available for firing anymore, okay? So that is the term, that property that I just described is what creates the term known as use dependence with the sodium channel blockers. Sodium channel blockers, they're use dependent because, again, they bind to a heart that is more in tune with systole, okay? That's more in tune with systole, right? So if a heart is going really fast. So one thing I want to say is that if you understand this use dependence ability, right, then you can see a property I'm going to talk about right now, actually. And the thing is, your class 1A drugs, your class 1B drugs, your class 1C drugs, they have very different abilities to unbind from the sodium channels that they have bound to and blocked, okay? So let's talk about the class 1C drugs. The thing is, the class 1C agents, right, so like your flecainide and propafenone, they unbind very slowly, very, very slowly from the sodium channels that they have blocked, okay? And the thing is, these drugs, because they unbind very slowly, they demonstrate the greatest sodium channel use dependence, right? So let's think about this for a second. Work with me here. If your heart is beating really fast, right? So if your heart rate is like through the roof, right? These class 1C drugs, they do not completely unbind from the sodium channels that they have bound to and blocked, right? Because again, remember that they unbind slowly, right? So they've not completely unbound before the next depolarization sort of comes along, right? So because they're not completely unbound, right, by the time you enter the next cardiac cycle, the block that these drugs exert on myocardium, on the sodium channels of myocardium, begin to accumulate, if you may, right? Because it's like, oh, you blocked the sodium channels. Because really, the right thing you're supposed to do as a drug, as these drugs, is you're supposed to bind and then you unbind. You bind and then you unbind. You bind and then you unbind. But these drugs, let's assume your heart is going really fast, they will bind. But before they unbind, it's like your heart has depolarized and repolarized again. And in that repolarized state, those use states, right? So like phases 0 through 3 of the myocardial action potential, the class 1C drug is like, oh, well, we almost spent no time in the depolarization phase. So I might as well just chill on this repolarized sodium channel, right? Because that's its preferred binding configuration. So if that happens, you keep accumulating blockade of your sodium channels, and if you keep accumulating the blockade, right, you keep letting your sodium channel sort of stay in that state where they're in use and not available for depolarization. If the block accumulates, you'll get to a point where you basically have blocked all your sodium channels. I mean, you probably will not reach that spot, but let's assume theoretically you reach that spot where you've blocked all your sodium channels, then your heart will basically not contract anymore because there's nothing aiding depolarization, and the person can go into a systole with that, okay? So because these your class 1C agents unbind very slowly, their blockade of sodium channels can accumulate very quickly, especially at very fast heart rates. Because at fast heart rates, you're spending a ton of time in systole. If you're spending a ton of time in systole, you're spending a ton of time in phases 0 through 3 of the myocardial action potential, which is actually the preferred binding spot for your sodium channel blockers. That's why they are known as use-dependent agents. So your class 1C drugs demonstrate the most use dependence because they unbind slowly. I know I've basically like talked about this in many different ways, but it's an important concept to understand, especially for those of you that are going into internal medicine or cardiology in the future. Okay, and then your class 1A agents, right? So they have like intermediate unbinding abilities, right? So they basically demonstrate intermediate sodium channel use dependence. And then your class 1B drugs, right? Your lidocaine, mexiletine, and tokinide, they unbind very quickly, okay? And because they unbind very quickly, they demonstrate the lowest sodium channel use dependence. Now, these drugs, they are basically used to treat bad tachyarrhythmias, right? So like VTAC, right? The thing is, they will not work if the person has a bradycardia, right? Because if you have a bradycardia, you're spending relatively more time in phase four, right? Where essentially these sodium channel blockers cannot work because they'd rather bind to phases 0, 1, 2, and 3, okay? But if you start getting a tachycardia, right, then these drugs start to work really well, right? Because again, you're spending more time in phases 0 through 3. Your class 1C drugs, they work very well, right? Because they have that high sodium channel use dependence, okay? But again, don't forget that they also have the largest risk of death due to the accumulation of their effects, right? Which can, again, ultimately lead to asystole, or as a YouTube cartoon I watched recently, asystole. Okay, it was like an ortho person arguing with an anesthesiologist, but that's a story for another day. Okay, so back to this. Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome, right? Basically, the pathophase involves having something known as a bundle of Kent that allows a signal, right, the action potential to travel from myocardial cells in the right atrium directly to the myocardial cells in the right ventricle, right? So you essentially bypass the AV node, okay, which is like a natural slowdown mechanism for the impulses that are flowing from the right atrium to the right ventricle. So how do we treat WPW? We treat it with procainamide. So procainamide, remember, right, it's a class 1A antiarrhythmic. Okay, it's the drug of choice for treating WPW syndrome because it suppresses myocardial excitability. Okay, so that it makes going through the bundle of Kent a lot less favorable than going through the AV node. Okay, but one high yield thing you want to know about procainamide is that it's in patients that are slow acetylators, it's actually associated with something known as drug-induced lupus. Okay, don't forget the association of drug-induced lupus with antihistona antibodies. And here's one very commonly tested exam factoid. If a patient has WPW, right, and they have AFib, and you give them a beta blocker for some reason, right, that's actually a pretty bad decision, right, because in WPW, that bundle of Kent, that bundle of Kent is like wide open, right? And your AV node, if a patient had like AFib, right? And usually for AFib, right, you give an AV nodal blocker, like a beta blocker, for example. But the thing is, if a patient has AFib and WPW, you give a beta blocker, you block the AV node, you're not blocking that bundle of Kent. And if you're doing anything, you're essentially increasing flux through that bundle of Kent. And that can cause some very nasty arrhythmias and cause a sudden death. So, if a patient, the big thing you want to remember is that if a patient has WPW, don't give them anything that can block the AV node, right? For example, you don't want to give them a beta blocker, you don't want to give them a non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker, right? So like verapamil, diltiazem. You don't want to give digoxin, right? So digoxin is an inhibitor of the sodium-potassium ATPase pump, but it's also a muscarinic receptor agonist, okay? So it can slow down conduction through the AV node because it activates the parasympathetic neurons that modulates the AV node. Another thing that can also slow down conduction down the AV node is adenosine, okay? So just sort of keep that at the back of your mind. That's why it's used to treat that's why it's used to slow down the heart relatively quickly if a patient has like AFib, right? It's basically like an outshoot of what do I want to say? It skipped my mind. I'm gonna keep going. Hopefully, I remember it at some point. So I'll jump to quinidine. Quinidine is one of the class 1A agents. It's a sodium channel blocker, but the super high yield thing you want to know about quinidine is that it's a muscarinic receptor antagonist. Okay, so because it antagonizes muscarinic receptors, it actually increases your heart rate. Okay, and because it has anticholinergic activity, basically, right, it can increase your risk of delirium. So you don't want to give this to the elderly, right? And another thing is that it can actually cause constipation and urinary retention, again, because of its anticholinergic effects, right? And one other thing it can do is it can cause something as synchronism. That's just one high yield thing you want to be able to associate with quinidine, synchronism, okay? Synchronism. That involves like tinnitus and like some other neurological issues that can arise with taking a quinidine. And the thing is, quinidine, if a patient like absolutely needs to take quinidine, but you don't want to speed up their heart rate, right, so that you don't get like all this badness with use dependence, you can actually give them digoxin. Because remember, digoxin has muscarinic receptor agonist activity, so it can sort of counter some of those nasty side effects that go along with quinidine. Okay, very high yield to know that. So I'm going to stop here. In the next podcast, I will go into more detail. In the next cardiopharmacology podcast, I'll go into more detail and finish up the antiarrhythmics. So I wish you all the best. If you have any questions, feel free to reach out. I also offer one-on-one tutoring for the USMLE step 1, 2, and 3 for shelf exams. Those are areas I focus on, although I can also tutor to med school exams. So feel free to reach out if you ever needed that. The email is divineinterventionpodcasts@gmail.com. And I wish you all the best. Have a great rest of the week, and God bless. Thank you.